of the House Community and Regional Affairs Committee. Today is Monday, March 14th at 3:06. Let the record show that Representative Cato, Collins, Savacki, and Springer are in attendance. We have a quorum on today's calendar. We have held over from last Friday House Bill 429, an act relating to an optional exemption from municipal property taxes. House Bill 227, an act relating to joint insurance arrangements. Both these bills have had previous readings. And House Bill 422, an act relating to payments for purchases by public corporations of the states, Alaska Commercial Fishing and Agriculture Bank, school districts, and municipalities, and provided for an effective date that is being read for the first time today. We take it up in that sequence. We go first House Bill 429, that was scheduled for last Friday. And I have given to the prime sponsors, Representative Donnelly was the mastermind behind it. I have given him a letter from David McCabe, which raised some concerns in regards to that bill, and that has given the committee a chance to go through that letter. And it's in your folder now is the, not necessarily a rebuttal, but an explanation letter from Representative Donnelly. It's labeled Exhibit 11, and the letter from Mr. McCabe is labeled 9. Maybe I think, considering the observations Representative Savacki had, maybe we go through that because I think it may answer all the concerns we had. We are working from the CS for House Bill 429 that was adopted on the 2nd of March.
That was the one labeled 1.2.
1.2. That's the final CS work draft.
There are two others.
I turn it over to Representative Donnelly. Maybe if we just follow the way you have answered it right now, then I open it to discussion at the end of that, if you would.
Mr. Chairman, are you referring to the letter from just going through the response to the letter?
Yes, your response to Mr. McCabe's letter. I think it's all there in writing, but I think for the record, I'd just like to go through pretty fast.
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. One of the concerns from people have raised is what if somebody was to put something up and then take it down to gain this tax benefit? All along, the philosophy behind this legislation has been to allow the local community to adopt their regulations and how they want to run this program. But since we've added the word completely to the committee substitute, that whole argument is inappropriate anyhow, because they'd have to completely remove all improvements on the property. The same concept of possibly moving a trailer home onto the property. Afterwards, the committee substitute addresses that issue also, so that they wouldn't have be able to commercially or residentially utilize the property. The exemption would only remain in effect while it wasn't in utilization. Once again, Mr. Chairman, I think it would be really easy for a local government to address that, but we've got it in there in the committee legislation, the committee substitute now. Clearly, the local governments can adopt regulations to deal with this if they want to adopt this, since it's a municipal option law in the first place. They don't have to do it if they don't want to. 5, the point about 5 once again was what about a parking lot, being able to create a parking lot and make income. Once again, Mr. Chairman, the committee substitute was designed to address this. So that's pretty much it. It's pretty self-explanatory.
Okay, any discussion on that from the committee? I note here we have you referred in your answer on number 5,
yeah,
that referred in the packet as 1.3. and that is work draft 5-1668L. There's also one marked 1.4. And the changes and the differences are in the section on whichever one you want to use, 9.1.2 is line 15, the reference to the historic district commission or entity. The first reading, we had a discussion around that. And the 1.4 doesn't make any reference at all to it. And 1.3 still has a local historic district commission or entity. However, it has in the last sentence an exemption. It has 10 years changed to 5 years. So there are three variations up. We are working right now for the sake of discussion. We are working with 1.2.
Mr. Chairman, then I would the crucial issue I guess the committee dealt with last time was this question about whether the State Historical Society should be involved, or whether there should be specific provisions for Historical Society. And before the committee now are two drafts, one with and one without. 1.3 has the historical preservation language, and 1.4 does not. I'm open to, it's the will of the committee on this.
We have multiple choice here. We've got a 10-year, a 5-year historic commission, and none. And we're going to work our way towards a solution. If that concludes your testimony, any more questions to Representative Donnelly? If you just stick with us a little bit, we have State Assessor Mike Worley here yet to testify on it, and then we see where we go.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mike Worley. I'm the State Assessor representing Community and Regional Affairs. We've worked out any differences that we had with the staff of the sponsor of the bill. Just as a clarification, word of clarification, on the versions 1.3 and 1.4, either of which we do not object to at all, just to clarify what happens with those differences between those two versions. In 1.3, it says basically that the exemption is approved by the local assessor after consulting with the historical folks. Now, we don't have any concern one way or the other about whether the historical commission is included in the bill language. We're not concerned about it. What we're doing here is, this was at our suggestion, is to make it clear that there's only one person in the municipality who has the authority to approve or deny an exemption, and that's the municipal assessor. So what it's saying is that he must first consult with the local historical folks, and then he may approve or deny the exemption. In version 1.4, it goes without saying that the municipal assessor is the only authority who can grant or deny an exemption, and so therefore it's not necessary to say in the bill. The municipal assessor grants or denies exemptions every day. So it's not really necessary to say the local assessor, and we're not concerned whether it says it or not. But the purpose of version 1.3 is to simply say that the local historical commission does come into play, but they do not grant the exemption. One other thing is that we would like it to be clear that our general position is to exemption bills is that we don't like the part of an exemption bill that causes a shift of the tax burden locally. And we don't like the fact that it makes it difficult or annoying to administer. But there are, on these municipal option bills, we do not take a position in opposition to these bills as long as they are trying to serve a good public purpose and they've been well thought out and they are consistent with existing law. It was at our suggestion that the sunset clause contained in 1.3 and 1.4 be 5 years. That way you can take a look at the economy and see if you still need this thing or still need these exemptions. In the case of House Bill 429, we do not object to the bill. We think it's trying to serve a good public purpose, and the 5 years would be consistent with existing law and under several subsections. And we think that the passage of this bill does not shift the tax burden, it does not reduce the tax base at all. What it does is it gives municipalities choices. And if it's worthwhile to them to reduce that tax base or shift the tax burden, then they can make that decision locally. That's all our testimony. We'd be glad to answer questions if there are any.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Worley, Representative Sawacki?
I just have one, either Mr. Worley or the sponsor. If 1.3 was implemented, if for some reason somebody forgot to call the Historical Commission or the entity out there, what ramifications would there be, if any? Or what could somebody say, as long as they don't have any jurisdiction or decision-making, we can totally ignore them?
I think that's a valid question. I doubt that it would happen, knowing each assessor in the state of Alaska. Whenever legislation like this is passed, he adds that to his checklist of things to do whenever one of these things comes up. I think each assessor would do it religiously. Now, you know, anyone's capable of an error, and if he did overlook it and didn't contact the Historical Society, I don't know. Certainly, it's the intent of this legislation is obvious that he is required to talk with those folks, and if he didn't talk with them and granted an exemption and the building were torn down as a result of it, then the municipality would be liable, I would think, if there is liability there. But I don't know what the liability would be, you know, because what's happened is you have now lost a building which may or may not have been of historical significance to that community, and I don't know how you would measure that liability. After all, the person who owned the building, you know, was willing to demolish the building, so I don't know. If there's liability there, I guess that it would fall on the municipality, but I can't imagine what liability there would be.
Other than the fact that it just adds another level of requirement, and then going to either the Historical Commission, they've got to make sure that they are going to be in a time frame to get their committee together to make a decision to pass back to the assessor, who in turn packs it back to the municipality.
Yeah, and we have no position one way or the other as far as that Historical Commission is concerned, if they are or not involved.
Representative Cato.
What is the number of years a Historical Commission or Historical Commission would consider a building historical? I'm sure it's more than 30 years.
We just passed a school bill that ranged from 32 up to 60 years.
Yes, that's right. I think right now there are two categories, some of them that are on the National Register. They are recognized and cataloged. And I don't think there's any problem with those at all, because there's already existing legislation to protect those, even if they're under private ownership, because when those people get public funds to maintain and restore them, they sign those type of agreements. I think where the question mark comes in are those that somebody may consider of historical significance and the owner disagrees and says, hey, that's just a piece of junk in its mind. We had a couple cases, I think, like that in downtown Anchorage where the municipality got involved and said they had historic significance and the owner disagreed with them, and I think they ended up, the municipality ended up paying for the removal and restoration or something like that. Under option 1.4, I think that wouldn't be covered. So if some private person says, I'm going to get rid of that piece, they're not going to do anything, and I'm not sure if there are any further requirements for them other than to go ahead and remove it. On the other hand, a municipality made by ordinance, that doesn't preclude them addressing that problem in the ordinance and say, hey, before we grant your removal rights for anything 30 years under and give you the tax break, it has to be run by a historic commission or something, the way it is spelled out in 1.3. I have really mixed feelings, because I think some of the stuff which we call historic monuments right now are nothing but pieces of junk, you know, and somebody's getting public funds to keep them and restore them. And Representative Donnelly.
Chairman Springer, just to address that issue, what I think would happen under 1.43 is if somebody brought a lawsuit before the destruction took place, I think they could stop it if they hadn't complied with the law. But after the destruction, I don't know what their standing would be to have any protests, since there was no, you know, if they had standing on another grounds, they could have brought a lawsuit anyhow. But if they're just a member of the public that was concerned that this thing was destroyed, and I don't know what their damages would be, it'd be real difficult to assess. So they could, though, I think, halt something from being tore down if this wasn't done.
I view 1.4 for my personal thing, just for the sake of discussion, as a more favorable instrument, because number one, it's simpler. Number two, it doesn't rob the municipality of writing in the ordinance whatever they want to do. I look at that legislation as a tool to assist municipalities and private owners to clean up the town. And the less encumbrance and the less paperwork and red tape is involved with that, the better. I like it. That's my comment. Any further discussion on it? Would there be any reluctance from the committee to adopt 1.4 rather than 1.3? It's just an informal question, not a motion.
Would you like a motion on that, in fact?
Well, yeah, but yeah, I entertain a motion then to rescind 1.2 and adopt CS for House Bill number 429, labeled as Exhibit 1.4, reference 5-1668X.
I so move.
Any objection to that? We have adopted, say, the simplest version, 1.4. Any further discussion on that? Representative Savacki.
Yeah, well, I do on the bill itself. I know I've talked with Representative Donnelly and his assistant. My concern, again, is that when you tear down that building and give them a five-year exemption, there's still a tax base out there. And that tax base is going to have to be picked up and spread across that entire municipality. Now, as the staff assistant was saying, sure, maybe a $1 or $2 increase, but the fact remains that every year, as you continue to tear down the building and continue to build five-year exemptions on these properties, that tax base is going to get bigger within that municipality, and it's going to have to be shared by everybody. Also, you're going to set up a bureaucracy that's going to be required to either somehow inspect or guarantee that those properties do stay vacant for that five-year period. And as you get in your first year, your fifth year, your tenth year, or whatever, you're going to create a bigger and bigger bureaucracy, having to go out and inspect or check properties to see if they're vacant. And that's why I have a serious problem with this bill. First of all, you're spreading a tax base. By tearing down a property in itself, you've already eliminated part of that tax base. I don't see any reason why you should eliminate the tax base for that raw piece of land. But by giving that five-year exemption, you spread the tax across everybody. And then you've got to set up a governmental bureaucracy to maintain that, as I said before. And that's going to be the problem that I could see down the line.
Any other discussion?
I don't disagree with Representative Sawacki. I have a different way of looking at it. And again, we don't like to refer to the lower 48, but I have known of various vacant property within towns where there's absolutely no revenue derived, and that had old buildings on were taken off and then were eliminated from the tax rolls, and there was no revenue derived to the individual, and no possibility probably ever selling that vacant lot. And of course, these vacant lots, once they were sold, would go back on the tax base, am I right? And so I have a little bit of problem with your concern.
Well, they'd go on back on the tax base to the new owner, but the original owner would not be taxed, but there's still a tax base. If you have a lot that's,
yeah, that's what you're saying.
That is in the middle of it, a downtown Anchorage, and they tear down the building and they get a five-year exemption, that is still a taxable piece of property. And the municipality is either going to have to pick up that tax or increase the mill rate for everybody else.
Well, I live in a town. If that bill gets implemented, it ceases to exist.
And they'll take every building out of the town.
You bet. And The only decent property is government property, which is not on the tax base right now anyway, in simplistic terms. To me, the significant thing is twofold. Number one, that it is an optional thing for a municipality.
Right.
If it's a chunk town and the whole town ceases to exist, then they know it, the assembly knows it, the mayor knows it, that they're going to get in a big problem. The other thing is, I think I had the queasiness with the 10-year situation too, but I think 5 years is, from a tax roll standpoint, a reasonable and defensible period. And the third thing is, in Alaska in general, there just is a lot of junk grounds, just simply the way Alaska grew. A lot of things were out of the pioneer days, and they came in, and they were not kept up because of the way people moved around and were seeking opportunities. And we're in that transition right now where we are getting a more sedentary population, and we're trying to establish longer range programs and stuff like that. And I think it could help to clean up some of the junk areas.
Oh, I was just thinking what you said about a town ceasing to exist, then there wouldn't be any burdens on the taxpayers, because there wouldn't be any.
They all move into government housing.
Which is off the tax rolls.
Mr. Worley.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, if I may respond to one of Representative Zawacki's concerns, this expansion of the bureaucracy. In reality, each municipality has a staff of appraisers or an assessor in the small municipalities who has to go out every year anyway and look at new construction and check for additions where building permits were not issued and taken out, and that happens in every municipality. So basically, these people are traveling around the municipality anyway, and they could look at these vacant lots to verify that they're still vacant. Certainly, it would take them a little more time, but it would not be like creating, you know, its own bureaucracy. And having had experience as a municipal assessor for years and years, I don't see that it would be unmanageable, particularly with the computer systems that municipalities have now. If it's a small municipality, you can just look out your window and see if it's vacant. If it's a large one, then you have a computer system, so you can put that sunset right into your system, and in 5 years it'll pop up and you say, okay, here it is, the exemption ends. So I think, yes, there would be increased activity, and certainly there would be a shift in the tax burden. There's no question about it. But, again, we don't like those things, but this is a choice that municipalities may make. And if it comes up before an assembly or a council, we might very well contact them and say we think it's right or wrong for you, but we don't think it's our position now to deny these choices to municipalities.
Well, just on that point, if we remember last year when we were here, we also had a bill that was before us that addressed the challenges and the difference in regards to property valuations, especially in acreage that had something like 8,000, I think, if the number was right. And the excuse that the municipality used is we did not have the money to enforce it. We have a problem. So this is, again, the same thing. You've got a requirement that's going to be there year after year that someone is going to have to go out and address. Someone's going to share the assessor, but now you've given them that much additional burden. Now, I don't know how small or how large it is, but the assessor already apparently is being taxed, and you don't have the money to do what is properly done. We heard that all last year, and now you're adding more to that responsibility, which means you're going to have the same reason. We don't have the money, and we're going to have to hire people to take care of the old assessments plus the new assessments that you're adding to us. So again, you either use the excuse we have no money, or you add the bureaucracy to take care of the requirement that's going to be there and is going to increase year after year.
Mr. Chairman, we have some real good news for people from Anchorage. The municipality recently hired a gentleman named Steve Van Sant, who is the second best assessor in the state, to be their assessor out there. And Steve is, I have an awful lot of respect for Steve. Steve and I had a 1 6-hour meeting discussing the problems out there, and we've talked quite a number of times since then on the phone. Steve has some very good plans, some very good ideas for taking care of, these are time-proven ideas for taking care of the problems in Anchorage. We anticipate that within a year or so that the majority of the problems in Anchorage will be taken care of, the roll will be clean. A large part of the reason that there was a catch-22 problem in Anchorage was that because the assessor's office fell behind and it didn't have the opportunity to catch up. So Steve has some plans for taking care of those problems. We think that there will be some real improvements to the Anchorage situation over the next year or two, and we think that this would not provide any kind of undue burden on that office at this time. I think there were some management problems that existed there.
Okay, any further discussion? If not, we have adopted CS labeled 1.4. I would entertain a motion to move it from committee with individual recommendations.
I so move.
Any objections?
I'm going to object, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, hearing an objection, make a roll call vote. Shall committee substitute House Bill number 429, labeled 1.4, move from committee? Representative Collins?
Yes.
Representative Cato?
Yes.
Representative Savacki?
No.
Representative Springer, yes. The motion carries. Next one, we have House Bill 227, joint insurance arrangements. Is there anybody here going to testify?
Where's Taylor?
That's the prime. We have already read that one. Is the prime sponsor?
That time you showed up.
I have Mr. Scott Burge signed up to testify on that bill.
429?
No, 227.
Did you want to speak to the sponsor? Did you?
No, I don't care. Just join me. Yeah, sure. Just join us. Yeah. That's the second hearing on that bill, unless you want to add something during the discussion.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. You're not alone.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Scott Burgess with the Alaska Municipal League. I provided testimony for the last meeting. I don't have anything new. I'm sorry I was out of town when that hearing was held. I don't know what the response was to it. We had a few, couple basically, suggested changes that I think were an oversight, but I may be incorrect. From the sponsor, and one was section 5 on page 2, lines 17 through 26 should not be deleted. I think that was language we actually asked to be introduced, would allow us to participate in a super pool set up by municipal leagues, and perhaps the school districts may have something at the national level as well. And we actually had that language inserted, and I don't think that it causes harm to anybody or this bill, but it's something that we need in there for our program, which is another option in terms of trying to come up with the financial aspects of it. Now, I understand that under the bill, some of those are reduced in terms of what's required as surplus and fiscal backing or financial backing, but we would still like to see that language remain in the bill, and I don't think it would hurt the intent of the sponsor or the legislation.
Would you repeat, sir, please, which one
it's,
it was?
It's section 5 on page 2, mm-hmm. lines 17 through 26. It's shown as being deleted yeah. in there, and we would just assume that remain.
Reading except that an arrangement formed by municipalities or school districts.
No, it's just that actual language that was removed, which is really stuff that we had to put in there.
I'm a little bit confused here.
It would just be leaving the language that is now or shown in the bill before you in caps and in brackets, to remove the brackets and leave the language.
Well, the capitalized in brackets is being removed now.
Right, we're suggesting it not be removed.
Oh, you want to keep the whole thing in there?
It's a very specific language, and it's trying to address those, the National League of Cities has set up, the 23 leagues that have joint insurance arrangements basically around the country have joined together because excess markets have not been available. So they've created a pool among pools, and this would allow us to purchase excess insurance through that national pool. And there may be something comparable at this national school board level. I'm not aware of that, but it would allow them to do the same if something like that should be created for school boards.
I have no objection to
that either. Yeah, I'm just reading it through. It looks logical to me.
I think the reason it may have been excluded is that on the original draft, when we asked them to prepare it, it was, I asked them to prepare it in a fashion in which it had left the House 2 years before. And this was added over on the Senate side as one of the sections. And I think that's probably why the deletion occurred. And I hadn't had a chance to really talk with Mr. Burgess before he rendered his position paper. But I have no objection to that.
Okay, all right. Is that okay, though?
Mr. Chairman, I move that we remove the brackets, take the caps out, and leave the language in from the middle of the line on page 7, or on page 2, middle of the line on 17, down to the end of the line on page 26.
We have a motion. Does that affect before us? I was going to wait till Mr. Purchase has maybe other changes and adopt them all together, but that's fine that way. Are there any objections to that motion to adopt that? Hearing none, that is adopted then, and we change it accordingly. Did staff get the change? It removes the brackets and keeps the existing language in place. Well, please continue then.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, one other change. This would be in section 8, page 3, line 17. Real short one. It says it should be repealed. Our understanding is that subsection allows the JIA to provide workers' comp, and I don't think that's the intent of the sponsor. We want to leave that in there, so we would ask that section be removed, because what that section does is allow the joint insurance arrangements to provide workers' comp, which is a critical piece of insurance for any of these organizations.
There's no objection from the prime sponsor on that?
Again, I think it's a function of what was introduced last year, and as we went through the process, I think that was an oversight in the original bill, that workers' comp is a critical line that needs to be covered and addressed, and we added that through the process.
Mr. Chairman, I move we delete Section 8, AS 2176-010-D is repealed.
We have a motion before us. Any?
I just.
Okay. Any objections? Assuming that the testimony we hear is correct, that's been done.
It's not here.
I haven't looked up what 2176, but you've been a pretty good guy. We take your word for it.
It's not your trouble.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other changes or discussion for Mr. Burgess? I have a question while you're here. Last time, if I recall right, on page 117, we had a question in regards to the regional educational attendance areas. And I don't remember exactly what it was, but I wrote down here, it has a tax base and therefore it could not become insolvent. So that indicates that we could include our REAAs.
Mr. Chairman, they're actually under the existing law. This law would not change that.
It's just a repetition of existing.
Correct.
Now we have heard on Friday, I think it was, we have heard that in principle that is a desirable thing which the Alaska Municipal League is looking at right now in a somewhat different context. No, it wasn't Friday, it was last week sometimes. It was either Monday or Wednesday. This bill does in principle the same thing, just a little different way. I don't see any problem on letting that bill go to the next referral, which would be Labor and Commerce, and by that time the committee may have a draft for review up too, and then we can see either if those two bills could get combined later on or if each one can be used on its own merit. I don't see any problem either way because we don't know exactly yet. We directed staff to get together with the AML to draft something along the lines which you laid out the last time. So is there any more discussion on the bill from the committee or questions? We do not need to adopt the CS at that point, or we need to be, one of them we can call a technical amendment, but the last one is actually a change in the bill. So well, you wouldn't have any objections to adopting a CS?
No, not at all.
Okay, then I entertain a motion to adopt the changes as we have adopted them and make it CS on House Bill 227.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we amend the bill as voted and vote or move the bill out of committee pending the CS by the committee.
Any objections to that? Hearing no objections, so moved.
Thank you.
You got all the
thank
changes,
you again,
Mr. Chairman.
I really appreciate
you.
It.
Bet.
He said the first year is only the $1.5 million. Only the $1.5 million. It's going to have to be spread across a smaller tax base.
Who is all on the next?
Are you going
to have to do this? Yeah,
it's optional. Yeah, I would too. I'd scream my head off.
Well, somebody's up there.
Yeah, but I don't think you're going to find enough of them. Enough of a constituency out there, Jim, that would broaden your tax base by even 2 mills or 1 mill.
And it costs money to demolish this.
Oh, Christ, yes.
Particularly if there's anything that has asbestos in it, it costs a fortune to remove.
And you just can't knock them down
anymore. Yeah, you just can't.
Remove all the asbestos.
Is Don going to testify on that?
Yes, he's on his way back. He was testifying in another committee, so he's on his way to right now.
Okay. I got too many bills in the hopper.
Yeah, maybe he needs roller skates. The ones that go up and downstairs.
Well, we can go ahead. We have 3 witnesses signed up to testify, and we have also in the packet some committee substitutes already, but I wait till we hear from the prime sponsor which one he wants to work on. Maybe staff can maybe staff can explain to us what the difference between 1.2 and 1.3 are, so when we hear witnesses we can consider that.
Where are all these 1 points? I only see one.
Yeah. One of them is marked 5-1711X. That's 1.2, and then the other one is same
okay,
number,
I got
L.
It. Yeah, I got it.
Has everybody got that? Okay, maybe you can run down, assuming that 1.2 is the earlier version, just tell us what is being changed into 1.3.
Okay, actually, 1.2 is the exact same version as the original bill, except one section is added, and that's section 1, which is the purpose. And just puts it in what I would call plain English, what the bill does. And 1.3 mm-hmm. is the same bill, but only concentrating on municipalities and school districts and deleting public corporations of the state. And that's the only difference between the two substitutes.
Okay, maybe you can explain, Rio. Are you just being nice and giving us a multiple choice, or is there a specific reason for taking public corporations in Alaska Commercial Fishing and Agriculture Bank out?
The original intent of the sponsor was to just focus on school districts and municipalities. When the bill was drafted, after we realized Agriculture Bank and public corporations were added, which was not the intent of the public or the sponsor. And so we were concentrating on municipalities and school districts only. And that's what we wanted to bring it back to.
Okay, so that's what version 1.3 would do.
Exactly.
So are you saying then that it's the prime sponsor's intention at this point that we work off 1.3, or you want the
1.3.
Okay, well, if you can say that with your conscience, then we entertain a motion to adopt 1.3 CS for House Bill number 422.
I so move.
Any objection to that? We have adopted CS marked 1.3, reference 5-1711L. Okay, working from that document, then we have some businesses signed up. Gary Jenkins. For the record, please state your name and whom you represent, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Gary Jenkins. I represent the National Federation of Independent Business, an organization of small businesses across the state of Alaska. At the present time, we have about 4,000 businesses which are members of NFIB in Alaska. This bill would extend to local governments a requirement basically that they pay their bills in a reasonable and timely manner. For those who were in the legislature in 1986, legislation was passed that mandated this provision on all state agencies. I might comment that for those that are unfamiliar with how NFIB works, we do have one requirement that we cannot take a position before the legislature on any issue that the membership has not voted on. And I included this issue on our ballot, I believe, 2 years ago or 3 years ago, I'm not sure which year it was. Basically, our membership voted about 85% in favor, 10% opposed, and 5% that had no opinion. So it's an issue that's very strongly supported. The issue, of course, of prompt pay for state agencies was even more strongly supported because it was a serious problem. But it is a problem in businesses dealing with local governments and school districts of them not timely paying their bills. And to give you background, since basically this current state law is not listed in the bill, it basically says that from date of receipt of an invoice, of a proper invoice, the agency or the school district or municipality would have 30 days in which to pay the bill. There are some exceptions in the law which are provided for if the bill is not correct, or if the merchandise has not been delivered, or if the wrong merchandise was delivered, or the services were not correct. Those are all exceptions which stop the 30-day time frame. This would only deal with a proper bill delivered to the proper agency to pay it. I might note I have no idea what the position of the Municipal League and school districts might be on this, but I might note that when we were, the Department of Administration came out with fiscal notes about how disastrous that legislation was going to be for the state, and the last fiscal note that I could find in my files when I went back and researched it was that it was going to cost the state $2.7 million a year in interest to comply with that requirement. That fiscal note was zeroed out by House Finance Committee when that original legislation was going through. And in checking about 2 weeks ago with the Department of Administration, verified that from the effective date of the original legislation, which was October 1st, 1986, through the 1st of February this year, 1988, the state of Alaska has paid $34,000 and some odd in interest. So what that shows is that the legislation, as far as the state was concerned, did exactly what it was designed to do, and that was basically for state agencies to clean up their paying practices and get their bills paid on time, which was the original intent of that bill. And basically, that would be the intent of this legislation as it relates to school districts and municipalities, to say, hey, it's important that small businesses be paid timely when they're doing business with the local government. And I think the experience would be exactly the same, that it really would not end up costing a lot. It would just be a real strong inducement for local governments and school districts to timely pay their bills.
Thank you, Mr. Jenkins. Any questions?
I have just one. What particular reason, Mr. Jenkins, would a school district have for not paying their bills in a timely fashion? Other than bills, I mean, right. Correct bills.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cato, I guess it would be kind of the same thing to state. There's no specific reason, just people respond to whatever is deemed to be the priority thing at the time. And if in fact bill paying is given proper importance and bills are timely paid, this will never impact a school district or a municipality that's properly processing their invoices. But in checking with our membership, first of all, just like we said for the state, the vast majority of the bills are always paid on time. I mean, but there is a block of 10 to 20%. Somehow they end up on somebody's desk and nobody bothers to track them to find out what happened to them and why they aren't paid and this type of thing. There oftentimes are penalties on businesses for not performing or not delivering and this type of thing. And we just feel that this would basically just serves as an inducement for school districts, local governments to set up a system where they make sure they track their bills and get them out and get them paid in a timely manner. And it definitely has worked for the state. There were some agencies that were, you were looking at an average of 60 to 70 days for them to process it, and it's just because they had no incentive, and this has provided that incentive, and those days for processing has really dramatically improved. And it's evidenced by the fact that very little interest has been paid in a year and a quarter since the law was in effect.
I've worked on both sides of the fence, and I know some of the problems. I do have some questions, but I think I asked the prime sponsor. Any more questions to Mr. Jenkins at that point? Thank you very much. Maybe are you going to stick around?
Yes, sir.
A little bit? Okay. But before I go to the next two witnesses, we have the prime sponsor here with us. And you want to say anything on the bill? We have adopted version 1.3, which is the one that addresses municipalities and school districts only.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The main purpose or the thinking behind this legislation is that we really need to, if we've got money in state and local municipal coffers, it really in there, it's owed to the small business people out there. We ought to be going ahead and paying them because it's really tough right now out there in the economy. And I think they need the money a lot more than the local government needs it if the bill is actually owed already. And it's just a way to get that cash flowing out to the community in a more timely manner, Mr. Chairman. And it's been a big success on the state level, and we just thought it'd be appropriate to extend it to the local government level too.
Thank you. Any questions to Representative Donnelly? I got a few of them. I was involved in detail with the state when I was with DOT and working with the problem of 30 days. And 30 days certainly looks like a reasonable period considering the normal industrial and commercial standards in regards to paying bills. However, there were quite a few problems connected with it when you go into the details. One of them is simply a management structure. The state, a lot of state departments have, as a result of the things, gone to a more centralized way of doing business. Here we have a little bit of a different problem because state agencies, generally, the way the state management structure is, they have their headquarters office either in Juneau or Anchorage, and therefore they can address the problem because the regional offices either get authority to do the work themselves, or everything funnels back to a centralized system. Here we are talking about municipalities and school districts, and when we talk about municipalities, we may be talking about little towns in very remote areas. And from a practical standpoint, some of those towns, if you have dealt with them, or some of those communities, you talk about a mayor or a clerk, you're talking some real problematic areas. In some small communities, it functions very well. In other communities, for example, during the time of subsistence activities in July or August, the municipality isn't working. Everybody is out berry picking or fishing or doing something. Same thing, the turnover rate is really high. We've got to get into small technicalities like what ticks the 30 days off? Is that from the day the vendor gets a postmark on the bill, or is it from the day it gets stamped into the village? Is it then the payment day, the way it gets postmarked in the village, or when it gets delivered, or when the check is available? 30 days under some rural settings is not a very long period of time, especially if you consider sometimes a mail plane doesn't get in for 10 days or 2 weeks. Those are concerns to me. They are not a concern to state government because of the structure. They are concerns to some of the REAA and municipality locations. Second thing is the act of God aspect. Bad weather or something like that, that can cause delays. Are those penalties assessed then under those circumstances? Another question is one of tort. You know, right now, if state government or federal government, if somebody really screws up bad, you can go and sue that person directly. In the case of small municipalities, I don't think that's feasible. I certainly agree with the bill in principle. There's a lot of abuse, there's a lot of neglect, and unless there's pressure and incentive, like for example having to pay interest or something like that, I think it won't continue, but at the same time I see some practical problems. Maybe Mr. Purchase, when he testifies, can address that also, because the members of the Municipal League fall into the category I just described, so I just let Mr. Purchase come forward and testify then.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Scott Burgess with the Alaska Municipal League. Chairman, we're opposed to SB 422 because of the imposition of the state procurement code. We believe unduly restricts local autonomy. We understand that the state procurement code went through last year. We did not take a position in support of that bill or in opposition to that bill because it did not affect municipalities. I think and I'm not here to say that municipalities shouldn't pay the bills. That's not why the opposition. The opposition is, whereas the legislature sits in control of state agencies, we believe that this issue ought to be brought up at the local level, and the council ought to be passing ordinances if they need to respond to lack of payment of bills, and not the legislature putting its state procurement code on municipalities. We think it restricts local autonomy as outlined in Article 10 of the Constitution, therefore we're opposed. It's not so much, it's a philosophical aspect for the most part. This only puts on a very small part of the state procurement code onto municipalities, but really it seems to be an issue that needs to be addressed at the local level. I agree with the chairman's comments in terms of some municipalities that their business day is a lot different than maybe some that we recognize, but I think in general it's a situation that needs to be addressed at the local level by the local assembly or council. And so that's our opposition. Again, no opposition to the fact that bills ought to be paid, but it's just a situation of whether the council ought to be saying the bills ought to be paid, the assembly ought to be saying the bills ought to be paid, or the legislature ought to be saying it. And it's just a philosophical problem. And we've seen lots of times when the legislature sees it's a great idea to do something, and then eventually it works down as another idea. Why not let's do it for municipalities too? We saw that in senior citizens tax exemption. It's a good idea to do it statewide, and it won't hurt the municipalities. We'll just leave the we'll just pay them back, and now the money's not there, and some municipalities are picking that up. We also had a discussion of a piece of legislation, which the league is now not in opposition to, but in terms of how professional contracts are put together. The state came through a process and how the state ought to do it, and the municipalities were thrown in. We kept the municipalities out. Now municipalities, presumably through the league, have seen the light and feel that perhaps that is reasonable to deal on a design bid. But I'm going off the subject. But in fact, it's something the municipalities have the power to do. We think that they have the power to address this issue at the local level too, where it's a problem. I guess there's a question of whether, you know, to the degree, and I heard Mr. Jenkins' testimony, I haven't heard specifics. I know that when my bills come in, it says if you don't pay them in so much, you know, it starts adding up. And usually that is an incentive, and I understand that, but I think it's philosophical.
Thank you. Any questions, Mr. Burgess, Representative Sawacki?
Yes. Thank you. Scott, I think you can help me on this. I think Anchorage already has a specific time limit. They've already set it up through their assembly as to when payments are.
Mr. Chairman, Mark Johnson's here from the municipality of Anchorage. Perhaps he knows. I'm not familiar with the specifics in Anchorage, but it seems to me that there's a local businessman out there in the community that doesn't think it's getting a fair shake from the municipality, that if I were he or she, I'd be at the next assembly meeting, and after I wrote a letter to the mayor.
And I'm not sure, because I thought they also, just a couple of years, implemented a payment schedule on the Kenai Peninsula Borough. But again, as you're saying, it's an option that each local government can set up, and they can have 15 days, 30 days, 45 days, depending on what the payments are.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I understand, presumably from the sponsors, that they don't want that option, and I understand that, but I think that it is something that presumably can be addressed at the local level and probably should be.
Any further questions, Representative Cato?
No, I was just thinking a very parochial aspect, that I have some areas in my district that, as you say, the mailbag gets dropped once every 2 weeks. And they really have a problem with this. Doesn't mean they don't try to pay their bills in a timely manner. It just means that they don't get the mail, don't get the invoice, and then the mail might not go back out. At the same time, if they were under a penalty, I would have a problem with that.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, the 30-day period starts when the municipality is in receipt of the bill. So it doesn't start then, and then I would think under the common law, the deposit receipt rule. Is that right, Mark?
When the check is, well, when they receive the invoice, they have 30 days from that date, and assuming that they write the check 15 days later from the check and the invoice, they, you know, it's 15 days there, not when the person will receive it 30 days.
It's a deposit receipt rule, right? When they actually put it in the mail.
When they put it, yeah.
So if the mail was delayed, yeah, they get 30 actual days in possession of the bill,
right,
until they have to attempt to mail it or give it to the postal authorities. It takes 2 weeks or they lose it in the mail, they're still covered because of the deposit receipt.
Well, I see, again, here's another bill where you see both sides. Right now, I know for a fact that some smaller towns are very lax about the handling of any public document. It doesn't make any difference if it's a resolution or if it's a bill or whatever. Some of them clerks don't show up for 3 weeks, you know, and so be it. You know, fish start running, they're always City Hall, we know that there we go fishing. And not only that, you see everything from bouncing checks and nobody knows what, how much money is in the account. I mean, that's all there. If you want to see gross problems, go down Department of Administration and ask for some of the audit reports, and you see everything where the city manager took off with the village's money and went to Hawaii. But on the other hand, I see the businesses type too, but I have to not necessarily agree, but cite with the observation that not all entities in the state are the same. You've got entities like Fairbanks or Anchorage, which have basically the same setup as the state has in regards to automatic billing, computerized accounting systems, mailouts, and everything like that. But that's a far cry from an in-between town like Nome and Bethel and Kotzebue or some smaller village. And I think unless we find a mechanism to distinguish between the different abilities of those type of municipalities, I think a very sweeping thing like that just can't be lived up to. Representative Donnelly.
Mr. Chairman, we had considered having some sort of cutoff for insulating the smaller communities from this type of legislation, but the Community Regional Affairs Department didn't like that very much because of setting up a dichotomy between various municipalities and organizations would be very difficult to administer. Possibly some compromise could be reached as to the length of time that's considered, because although I doubt if the Municipal League, since they have a philosophical opposition, would ever agree to any length of time, I think among us we might be able to decide that certainly a quarter of a year, 90 days or something, would be more appropriate, sort of a seasonal type thing, so to take care of those people that go into seasonal governmental patterns. Maybe they pay their bills four times a year, but so I'm certainly open to those kinds of suggestions. What would be reasonable?
I guess it's just hard for me to understand that it's a burden for them to pay in 30 days within 30 days of receiving a bill, because I get my bills and I pay for them within 30 days. And I think that for the small business person, the day that you either order or the equipment or that you provide the service, you have incurred that cost. So you're carrying that cost for that length of time. If it's 3 months and 4 months, and I don't think it's fair to ask the small business person to carry that cost, and I really don't see any reason why they can't pay their bills in 30 days. I really don't. And if they've got a clerk who goes off for fishing season, then they ought to fire them and get somebody else who's going to be there to pay the bills. And I don't think that's a reason not to pass this kind of legislation.
Yeah, I've seen towns where the clerk was switched three times a week. and a lot of them have a real tough time even to get people into City Hall to run anything. It's not made up. I agree with you. First, the service is demanded by a municipality, and then when it comes to paying up for it, then some of them get awful lax.
Didn't we used to have and I don't know whether it's still a criteria or not, but 30 days was cash. At any time after that was considered running on a credit basis.
Yeah.
Is that still prevalent in the business world?
I think the business world has tightened up because credit has become so expensive. It used to be they give you, within 15 days, they give you 5% or something discount. They made an incentive to pay early.
Yeah.
Then they had up to 30 days, 2%, and after 45 days, the bill was delinquent, that type of deal. They gave you kind of a sugar carrot type incentive to pay early. But with the interest rates the way they were, and as hard it is to obtain credit, everybody has tightened up, including the vendors on the state deal. But we have Mark Johnson here yet with us from the municipality of Anchorage. Please come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. It's been an interesting discussion. It helps you frame what you're going to say. Our comments really are founded two different areas. Generally, we associate ourselves with the comments by Scott Burgess and the Municipal League. First of all, we think that the legislature is probably inappropriately getting involved in legislating what we consider to be more basically a local function. We have an 11-member Anchorage Assembly that exists to consider issues like this, how the municipality does business. I'm not sure. Mr. Jenkins didn't mention any specific problems that he might have had with our agency or problems that local businesses may have had with municipalities or school districts in general, and that might be a worthwhile inquiry. I think the point to be gained from that inquiry is that the appropriate mechanism is probably the local governing body, the assembly. rather than the state legislature coming in and amending Title 29 to require something. With regard, Representative Zawacki raised an issue that I'd be happy to check out for you, although it didn't come up in our discussions. With regard to, we may have already enacted an ordinance that addresses this topic, and I'd be happy to provide that information. Like I said, it didn't come up in our discussion on this legislation. If it was in place, it may have come up. I just don't know. I'd be happy to research that and get back with you. My second comment is that I think what you're dealing with here is actually ought to be viewed in terms of a resource allocation question. Our finance department has determined that compliance with this legislation might require us to hire a half-time person to compute interest payments. What that boils down to is we're going to hire a half-time person. We have a fixed or under the best circumstances, or diminishing under the likely circumstance, local revenues. We're going to take money away from a function that we're currently undertaking and hire a person to administer the statute. And we think that's the kind of resource allocation decision that ought to be left in the hands of the local government and not made by the legislature. We have enough budget problems right now to, in essence, establish a statutory framework that's going to cost us something more to do business, we think is a mistake. I did note in our position paper, the finance department does indicate that we currently have few vendor payment problems. Once again, I would urge you to explore just how, is this a perceived problem or is this an actual problem before you enact legislation on the topic. That's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any questions to Mark Johnson?
Well, I can tell you a little bit from a more historic perspective. Before the state law pertaining to state agencies was adopted, we got the computer printout showing the length of the number of bills and the lengths which they were due. And I remember distinctly there were pretty high categories in the 45 and 60 and even 90-day category. And the reason why they didn't get billed were manifold, but most of them just had too lengthy a bureaucratic run from this 15 signatures. Some people signing off, everybody signed off and covered their butt all the way through, and the next guy wouldn't move till that initial was on and that signature was on. And after that law was adopted, it shaped up pretty fast. They found out that they didn't need that many people covering there, but that three of them was enough. And they went to a computerized system and were generally more innovative. It was the same thing with payroll checks before clauses were adopted in the union regulations that a penalty was due if the paycheck wasn't out. We had cases where paychecks were 14 or 30 days overdue. Now, I know why the municipalities don't like it, for sure. You know, who wants to be pressed under another burden? But at the same time, the point that the city council or the municipal councils are ultimately responsible is true. But if there are blatant ignoration of procedures and payments by the city, who ultimately will come down on them? That's a legitimate state role, just like all things in Title 29 are legit. I know you guys wouldn't like it, but how necessary it is from a business standpoint right now, I couldn't tell you. I couldn't tell you. But I know with small communities, and I don't know where to draw the line, there are practical problems. That just simply are. I'm sure in the case of Anchorage, Fairbanks, or larger municipalities that are streamlined, that have a professional city manager in it and staff and so on, I think there wouldn't be any problem complying with the 30-day period. Representative Donnelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd just like to... One of the philosophical differences I see in this legislation on and the local control issue, really. And the prior piece of legislation that I was here with the committee on is that while that prior piece of legislation deals with a piece of property that's within a municipal boundaries and thus is integral to that and unique to that community, here we're talking about businesses that are statewide. We're not talking about businesses that are only within that locality. We're talking about businesses that are all around the state, doing business in the state, maybe even outside the state. And accordingly, Mr. Chairman, the constituency, if we were only talking about local businesses within that community, certainly they would have the voting rights within that community and would be able to establish whether that local community should pay their bills in a time constraint. But that's not the only people we're talking about. We're talking about people who are not in that community, that are doing business in that community, but that have no say in that local government. That's a very similar argument to the argument that's made as to do with why the federal government should be allowed local higher laws, but the state government not. It's because on the federal level, everybody in the nation's represented. So if the federal government says, let's allow this state to give a preference for people, at least everybody is represented. But when it comes to a local government and within the state, the businesses in Ketchikan certainly aren't represented and don't have any representation in what the local government in Barrow does. But they do have some representation in what the state governmental function is. And that's one of the philosophical differences between this and the previous legislation, as far as I see it, Mr. Chairman, to explain that. Secondly, the interest payments. I had a question for Mr. Johnson on the interest payments. Under the state provisions currently, the interest payments are calculated by the vendor. I was curious why the municipality would have to recalculate those or need another half-time person to do that when the state government doesn't use somebody to do that.
Well, I expect what you're probably going to see is someone that monitors the 30-day application. We obviously have an interest to, there's no doubt the legislation would be effective. It would be effective in making sure we paid on 30 days. It would probably cost us a half-time person at a minimum to constantly monitor those payments. Let's face it, flood is a fact of life. We have probably large enough purchases, I expect. We're not going to, that there will be some lag time before the receipt of the bill and payment. And I expect if a business is smart, we will probably try to push at the outer limits of that. I think that's the reality of the situation. It's not the pretty side, but it's nonetheless the realities of, I think, doing business, any businessman.
Mark, when you said that you'd have to have a half-time person to assess the interest, were you saying assess the concern or the amount of money that might accrue if the bills weren't paid timely?
I can't tell you exactly how finance would choose to put that, how to have that person function. They did indicate that it would cost a half-time person to monitor administration of this legislation.
But the word interest was your own word, or theirs.
What does it say? They say a part-time person to calculate interest payments.
Yeah, interest payments. That kind of bugs me just a little bit, in as much as, let's face it, if you have a grant, say, of $100,000 from the state or from somewhere, and you have bills towards that $100,000, if you kept that money in the bank yay many days longer, that would be so much more interest back to the municipality. Yet that vendor would be sitting out there hanging out, not being paid. Now, I'm not sure whether that's a credible statement or not, but I kind of think it is.
Yeah. Under the provisions of the existing law, as you're deciding to extend, maybe this points to the way that we ought to be looking. Is it provides incentives in the form of discounts for vendors to provide to state government under the current law. And that may be the way that you may want to look to address this issue, is not through the assessment of penalties, but provide some incentive for local governments and the state to
may I follow through?
Sure.
I don't think that's, Mark, that's hedging what I said.
Well,
my example was to say we had $100,000 out there. Now, I don't know how much interest they pay a day on $100,000. I have no idea. But say 15 days interest back to the municipality if they pay the bills in 45 days rather than 30. Might then be the incentive for the city not to pay, or the municipality not to pay their bill. And as far as local businesses offering incentives, right. Yeah, that's great. But this itself would be an incentive by delaying the bill for 15 days, which kind of bothers me.
Well, that's absolutely correct. I know villages that put, as soon as they get money from the states, they put it in a CD for 3 months and they just ain't going to pay until that CD comes due. That's how they do it. Sure, there's incentive for either side to either delay payment or early payment, which side of the interest you're on. Representative Donnelly.
Mr. Chairman, purely, if this was an economics classroom, I think the argument would be that if I'm a private contractor doing business with a municipality, and I know they've got a propensity for delaying their payments, I'm going to adjust my bid on issues or adjust the charges that I'm going to make them based on my chance to, what my business climate is. In fact, I think doing business with the state, I mean, we've seen it's a lot easier now than it was before this legislation was passed, and I bet that the cost of doing business has gone down for these people. We might be saving money. So in a purely economic, this money is going somewhere. So it should all balance out, and we're just really dealing not so much with costs for local government, but a philosophy of whether people should be paid on time.
Anybody else that wants to testify? Is that person that wanted to testify on the telephone? Committee substitutes acceptable to him.
Thanks, Bill.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Carl Rose. I'm with the State School Board Association. And I can see both sides of the issue as well. I'm a private businessman, and I have had occasion to enter into contracts with state entities. To my recollection, I've never encountered some of the problems we're talking about.
How do you spell your last name? We don't have
Rose, here. R-O-S-E.
R-O-S-E, okay, thank you.
I do have a problem or a concern, and that lies with school districts. As you know, many school districts are, during a summer interim period, they're a lot of the small school districts, there's simply nobody around. So there would be a time lag, possibly somewhere to 30 to 45 days, that if bills were received anyway within that time, they may not have the personnel to maybe on staff during that period of time to handle those bills. I only see that as maybe a glitch. Perhaps something could be done about that. I really don't know. But a lot of the small school districts, school personnel normally about 180 to 180 to 220 days, maybe, whether they be administrators or certified personnel. And during a period of time that those people are either on vacation, normally they allow their classified staff to take vacation during that time as well. So there would, in fact, be no one in some school districts. And I know Skagway happens to be one of them. That's my hometown. And I do know on behalf of a lot of small businessmen, if in fact people are slow in paying their bills, the word seems to get out, and it's the cost of doing business if you do business with these people. So you do have the option of not doing business with the people who don't pay on time. But anyway, I did want to bring that to your attention. There are some school districts who simply don't have any personnel on hand in the summer, and that would be a problem.
Representative Collins.
I guess my thought is that if they were going to be gone for 3 months, that they could pay their bills in advance as much as possible, so that they would not disadvantage someone.
I'm all in favor of paying your bills on time. I know as a businessman, I kind of like that. Mm-hmm. But it would be an area of concern.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
So you mentioned that possibly 60 days would be appropriate, or did you have an idea about what their administrative shutdown time is?
They vary from district to district, but I would say it would at least be a 30-day period of time, possibly, where they would be nobody in some of those districts. in some districts, maybe a little bit longer than that. I really don't know.
Representative Donahue.
Mr. Chairman, I was just looking for some sort of accommodation for the time period here, if there's something we could... Because I'm real flexible as to, you know, I certainly share your concerns about these smaller villages that have the seasonal functions and for school districts that was to close down. But I still think we have a good concept. If we can find an accommodation for a time period, I'm really open to do that. But it won't cause a real hardship on these folks.
Representative Collins.
Well, I would say that technically, if there was nobody there to receive the bill, then the bill wasn't received until someone was there to receive it. I mean, when something comes into our office, it's automatically stamped in. So if there's nobody there to stamp it in July, they don't show up until August, they stamp it in. To me, that would be when it was received, if you really got down to nitty-gritty and on it.
Simply a point that I wanted to bring up. If in fact there were a period of time where they were received, or say mailed on the 30th of June, and in fact nobody was in that office until, say, the 10th of August, that bill would not have been received for some 40, 45 days before it even be processed. So it could cause a problem. But I just wanted to bring that to your attention.
I think Mr. Purchase wants to talk.
We're just discussing when received, how does that work?
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing.
Yeah.
You've got cases where you have certified or some proof of delivery, but in most cases, you got somebody moseying over to the post office that's kind of caretaker or somebody picks everything up. If there's nobody around, it just goes on that table. And then when the poor sucker comes in the office, the next time there's that huge pile of stuff, and he's I don't want to start touching that, and walls is out again, and goes very big. And that's really how a lot of it happens. I'm not making that up. And while we were talking, I tried to come up with some distinguishing mechanisms that's not blatantly discriminatory. And in a way, whatever I came up with, it either rewards sloppiness by, if we leave it out completely and say, well, those poor people can't perform, that rewards sloppiness and gives them more incentive not to do anything. And in a way, it penalizes those that are performing already or trying to perform. I just haven't found anything. Size isn't a good deal. Mechanics of accounting system isn't a good deal. Trying to identify periods of absences in the form of calendar periods is not a good way of going. I think it's one of those deals. I think in a democratic process, my feeling is let it come out on the floor, and then everybody can decide on their own basis what is good, and let majority opinion rule. I haven't come up with the magic, so if I would have something open for discussion to come up with a compromise, I'm certainly amiable to that. Representative Collins.
I guess the frustration that I have is that if those schools need those goods and those services, then they ought to make some arrangement to pay for them.
Right.
And if that means that they have to have somebody come in while someone else is on vacation, they do it. But I think it's really unfair for them to have the small business person or the business person carry the burden.
Or in a lot of cases now, what they are doing, they have the bookkeeping contracted out, the mechanics of it, you know, their accounting of for capital projects or grants or something like that. And where it hangs up is usually those firms that have the contracts don't have the signatory authority to disperse funds. They prepare them in something, and then typically it goes to the superintendent or chief clerk or whoever it is in the REAA to do that. But I in a way share that assessment. If you are around to receive the goods and the services, then you should be able to be around to get the money going.
And Mr. Chairman, I mean, there's a thought here. If it's more economically advantageous for these people not to have somebody there and receive the interest and just pay the interest, they could still make that economic judgment on their own. Just to pay the interest. It may be cheaper than hiring somebody to do that bookkeeping. And that's a valid thing. And then the small business person gets compensated appropriately for them making that economic evaluation.
Yeah,
and they come back and want a cost differential increase because they get too much interest they're paying.
That's the next bill.
But I mean, we're not talking about the world 5%. Coming to an end here if they don't make the payment within 30 or 60 days or whatever number the committee was to decide. Just simply they make the economic assessment that it's more advantageous for them in their own particular circumstances. Go ahead and pay the penalty.
Open to anybody in here. Does anybody have any suggestion on a compromise situation? We have pretty rigid lines drawn here, and on a total situation, I don't have those tight lines. I don't agree necessarily with the statement that the state got no business to monkey around in municipal affairs like that. But from a practical aspect, I see things on the lower end where they have legitimate concerns, not necessarily problems from the vendor standpoint. The vendor delivers, the vendor has a right to expect prompt payment. Any words of wisdom?
Yes. I just have one question of clarification, and this is my own ignorance. Is municipality or local government not required to pay interest on late payments? Or?
No,
they're not.
They pay no interest.
Unless there's specific legal language on the bill, which you agree to, that, in the form of your contract, it depends what type of deal you have. Usually in larger scale contracts, those details are spelled out. If you just have a vendor type situation, you know, where you have a blanket contract, let's say with an office supply outfit, where you charge somebody up to $1,000 they can go and buy under their purchasing authority, then usually that's not spelled out.
So they're statutorily exempt from interest unless entered into agreement that...
Unless you have some contractual agreement. Would you just, for the record, state your name and phone?
Marla Huswith, Kenai Peninsula.
Thank you.
Maybe I'm getting off this subject entirely, but she brings up a good subject. I know my doctor and my dentist, specifically, when they send me my bill, have X amount of interest over 30 days, 45 days, 90 days. And that's no contract with me.
Well, that's an implied contract when you get those services. Mm-hmm.